I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is President Jeffrey Mearns. Jeffrey is the president of Northern Kentucky University, and you personally have been here as the president for a little over a year. What's been the most surprising thing about NKU?
Well, I would say two things. One is it's clear to me that there's a great deal of pride in the university, both on campus and throughout the region. People who are associated with the university, either directly or indirectly, are very proud of the things that we've accomplished here at the university, and they're very optimistic. That's the second thing. They're very optimistic about the future of the institution. We all know that there are a lot of changes, a lot of challenges to higher education, but people on campus and people in this region are optimistic that our institution is up to the challenge.
Well, how are you planning for some of the changes that will no doubt be taking place?
For the past several months, we've embarked on a strategic planning process, which has been very inclusive. We've had 10 open forums on campus, and we actually had 20 separate community forums with business leaders, elected officials, school superintendents. So we set out to gather as much information, as much input from across the region as we could. And we're now at the part of the process where the committee is meeting to finalize the strategic plan, and we'll be presenting our proposal to the Board of Regents on November 13th.
So is there anything that you can share in terms of where some of your focus points were?
Well, I think first and foremost, we start with our commitment to the success of our students. And by success of our students, we not only mean their timely graduation from the institution, but that we're preparing them for a very dynamic world. So we're focused not simply on getting them their first job, but preparing for a meaningful career and a rewarding and fulfilling life. So that is our first goal, and that is the paramount goal of the plan. There then are a variety of other elements that I think are of interest. One is we are proud to be a relatively young institution that's nimble and is innovative. So you're going to see in our strategic plan a focus on academic innovation, which includes everything from incorporating technology into the classroom and providing hands-on, real-world experiential learning opportunities for our students, both on campus through undergraduate research and other projects, as well as out in the community in co-ops and internships.
Some of the wonderful thing that's gone on here at this campus during the time we've been doing this segment is phenomenal. The informatics program that you have, the success of that program, and the job placement, and the way you've really engage the entire business community and others in the region to help the success of these students is just inspiring.
Right. And informatics is a perfect example of what we want to do going forward. It is a way in which it's an interdisciplinary program. We brought together disciplines from different colleges, united them in a single unified college, but they provide broad experiences for students to prepare them for the 21st century. And so that is an example of the kind of innovation, transdisciplinary programming that you'll see continuing to permeate throughout our programs.
You've actually opened a center called the Student Success Center. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what that's about.
Well, I inherited a great plan from my predecessor, Jim Vitruba, who did a wonderful job here for 15 years. One of the ideas that I inherited from him was the renovation of the University Center, which had previously been the Student Union on campus. And so we spent about $6 million renovating an existing building to essentially bring together the various student support services and activities which had been previously spread all across campus, to bring them together into one location so that a student knows that whatever kind of service or whatever kind of question they have, they can come into that facility and they're going to be able to get an answer to that question.
If folks listening today would like to learn more about Northern Kentucky University and some of the initiatives and just the school in general,
they go to nku.edu, to our website, which is filled with a lot of information. And if they're interested in learning about the strategic plan, there's a link on our website to the planning process.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Jeffrey Mearns. Jeff is the president of Northern Kentucky University. And one of the things that you have been very busy doing recently is developing a new strategic plan. I know that one of the things that NKU does, in my mind, better than many universities I've ever been involved with or associated with, is that you're able to engage the community. You really have developed a partnership with businesses and various other organizations in the region to really help our region grow.
And if you think, you know, we're a relatively young institution, it was founded because the people in this community recognized the need for an institution like NKU. From our inception, it was an institution that was designed to be responsive to the community, that would establish partnerships throughout the community so that we are serving the needs of that community.
Well, and it's hopefully mutually beneficial, right? I mean, you're serving their needs, and hopefully they're helping serve some of your needs. They provide you some talent and resources as well.
That's right. And we see it as a partnership. And as a partnership, there are mutual responsibilities and then, of course, mutual benefits. We certainly benefit from the support of the community, and we believe the community benefits by what we do here on campus. But for us to continue to do what we're doing, and in fact, for us to continue to excel, we need to continue to maintain and obtain the support of the community and all of the members of this community.
So someone listening today who may not be as engaged as they could, how should they approach the university to see if there's some way that they can also be a partner with NKU?
Well, there are a variety of ways, and I'd begin right at the outset, which is we are now an institution that is the first choice for the most talented students that are coming out of high school in this area. And so one of the first ways you can get engaged is identify NKU as a place for the best and brightest of the high school students in the area. The other way is we have the Scripps Howard Center for Civic Engagement, and there are a variety of opportunities for institutions that have needs for either student interns or a variety of other support to engage with the university through the Scripps Howard Center.
Just from a competitive standpoint, if we want to continue to attract the best and the brightest individuals to work here in our companies, is that we have to attract best and brightest businesses, right? Really good businesses who can grow and offer those kinds of career paths that these young folks want to be able to participate in.
That's correct. I mean, if you think about what businesses need or what the civic community needs, they need talent. And universities are a place that attracts talent and develops talent. And so there clearly is a benefit that we provide, and we value that relationship.
Another issue that I know that's very important to the university and to you is funding. How and what is the university's top funding priority?
Well, going forward, the next big idea after our College of Informatics is to create a center for health innovations. This is going to be an interdisciplinary center where we'll bring together disciplines that are presently in different areas of the campus or disciplines, programs that we don't presently offer that can focus on improving the health of the community population. It will be designed to help consumers, health consumers, make better choices and also to provide opportunities for healthcare professionals to learn how to work together as a team in order to improve health outcomes. So we think it's going to be a center that will drive down the cost of healthcare but improve health outcomes. And what we want is we want the input from the healthcare community into the types of programs that we should have, into the curriculum and the design of those particular programs. We would also like them to help us think about how to design the building, not just the curriculum, but also design the building. And we would also welcome their financial support so that we can be able to build this facility. It's going to be a great resource for the community, and we're going to get it done in the next 2 to 4 years.
And again, if someone listening today would be interested in learning more about that initiative as well as about Northern Kentucky University in general,
I would encourage them to go to our website, which is nku.edu, and there it's a pretty easily to navigate website.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
This is BusinessWise. Tom, a column that we wrote in the Inquirer last week was really a result of a question that someone had. And this is certainly a common question that I think faces a lot of specifically family businesses. And that is, how do you keep and motivate talented employees? How do you keep them in your family business without relinquishing ownership?
Well, and that's tough to do. And most family businesses, or at least many family businesses that we deal with, do not want to give up stock, at least to people outside of their family. But they may have key employees who aren't family members that they want to continue to incentivize and reward for their performance.
Absolutely. You want to keep those superstars, the one that can really help your business grow, help your overall family's wealth and value of your business grow. So how do you do it then if you don't want to give up ownership? Because many of these highly motivated people do want some type of equity.
One of the incentive plans that we talked about was a phantom stock plan. And giving somebody an incentive that has the name phantom in it on the surface doesn't seem like a really good idea.
Sounds mysterious, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was probably dreamed up by an accountant or a tax lawyer. But really, what it means is that it's similar to stock, but it's not really legally stock.
There's a lot of the rewards that come along with stock ownership, assuming that you really do help increase the value of the business. One of the best things that it is, in fact, considered a deferred compensation plan, it's a non-qualified plan, which means that as a business owner, you can pick and choose who you want to participate in the plan. It does not have to be, quote, qualified, available to every other employee.
That's the good news about it being non-qualified. The bad news from the business owner standpoint is they don't get a deduction when they start the plan. They don't get a deduction until the employee vests in the plan and has a right to it, in which case the employee has income and the employer gets a deduction.
Yes, but if they're set up properly, typically there's no cash that is paid to the employee until some future date anyway. So even though the employer gives up rights to future income, the way I look at it, it's income they may not have had otherwise had the employee gone someplace else. So it's a win-win situation in many cases if they're structured properly and the right type of measurements and incentives are included in the plan to drive the kind of performance that rewards that employee.
One other benefit of a non-qualified plan, and specifically this one, is there's a certain amount of flexibility because you don't have that many rules that you have to adhere to. So you can be flexible in terms of how you measure what that phantom stock unit is going to earn, how you're going to measure the return to the employee.
That's right. Because it's a non-qualified plan, there's a lot of flexibility in designing that. And the way a typical phantom stock plan works is the management actually selects the employees to participate, and then they credit each one of those participants with a certain number of, quote, what I call phantom stock units. Each unit then represents a share of that employer's stock. And when that stock unit is granted, there's no income to the employee, as you mentioned, but you place a value on that stock unit of the company stock. It runs parallel with the company stock value at the time it's granted. And then from that point forward, any appreciation is credited to that employee's stock unit. It's really not very complicated, but it does require some level of effort, some forethought as to what management's trying to accomplish in designing the plan.
That's right. And I think any incentive plan that's worthwhile requires a certain amount of forethought. And you're really doing these plans for higher level employees. You're not doing it typically for your rank and file employees.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Tom, contrary to popular belief, many people who should have an estate plan in place do not have one because they don't think they have enough assets to warrant an estate plan. But certainly that's completely untrue.
Well, it is, because they may not have enough assets where they have a federal estate tax, because nowadays, if you do proper planning, you can have $10,500,000 of assets and not have any federal estate tax liability. If you don't do proper planning, you can probably still have $5,250,000 and not have a liability. So that excludes most people. But that doesn't mean they still shouldn't have documents that determine how their assets are bequeathed to their beneficiaries.
That's right, because if you don't have something as simple as a will, then maybe your beneficiaries, the ones who you really want to benefit from the assets, will not be able to have access to those.
Well, and sometimes an even worse mistake than not having a will is not having a current will. For instance, I recall hearing of one person who left all of his assets to his ex-wife, which did not make his current wife very happy.
That was a very sad situation. So the key is to really take a look at your will, take a look at your other estate planning documents, and you don't have to die just to have an estate plan. A lot of folks who have disabilities are also in need of an estate plan. Decisions of who will take care of your children, who will handle your finances if you become incapacitated mentally, for example. It's just critical to think about those things while everything is still in good shape so that you don't have a problem down the road.
Well, I think the other thing we see people do is they may have a plan, but all of their assets are not held in a manner that's consistent with the plan. For instance, they may have a plan to leave all their assets to their children or their spouse, but their beneficiary designation on their retirement accounts is not consistent with that. So you need to make sure that not only do you have a plan, but that you follow the plan. A lot of people have living trust or revocable trust, but then they fail to title their assets in the name of the trust, so it's ineffective.
Or putting your children, your minor children, for example, as the beneficiary when they may not be old enough to be financially responsible to handle the kind of assets that might be coming their way. There's just a lot of things to think of. something as simple as a type of trust. You know, there's terms called living trusts or irrevocable trusts, and understanding the differences, because sometimes when you make a decision, you can't fix that. You can't go back and change what you've done previously. So it's just critical to work with people who are professionals, people who understand your situation, to provide you with the advice and the guidance so that you don't make a mistake.
Don't necessarily rely on documents that you executed 25 years ago to be still valid.
And I know a lot of people don't like to think about this because estate planning is not something fun, but the way I approach this with our clients, at least, is I also try to weave into current income tax savings. So if there's a way that you can design your estate plan but yet get a current income tax benefit at the same time, again, it's something to think about. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Stephen Arthur. Stephen is an IT consultant with Tata Consultancy Services. And Stephen, we're here today to talk about an event that's happening on October 29th right here in the greater Cincinnati area, the Business Technology Summit, something really businesses of all sizes can take advantage of and learn something. Maybe you can share some of the details.
The Business Technology Summit is an event that's focused towards business owners and managers, any owners and CEOs or C-level members of teams. And we're really assembling a bunch of speakers to exhibit and speak on topics about technology, especially strategy, technology, and change.
Well, and it sounds to me like if you're talking about strategy, technology, and change, that would affect almost every business, it seems.
I mean, any business that's large enough to have a website is going to be impacted by technology.
There's so many companies out there who have a website. They're really not using technology the way that they could, correct?
Sure. One example that is really applicable to that is that if someone logs in and a website's slow, they might not take your business seriously, especially if you're in a completely unrelated domain. Still, people are going to check out your business by going to your website first.
I know that one of the topics that you talk about and one of the important issues that people should pay attention to is measurable results from their technology.
Absolutely. As a performance consultant, that's my main line of work. I help enterprise companies optimize their enterprise IT systems. And really, we focus on measuring performance in order to improve it. Measuring is the first step. So technology dashboards help you measure your system utilization and as well as your critical business processes.
And how often should you be looking at those measurements?
Well, in the simplest form, you can have a stoplight. Green means everything is okay. Yellow means you need to take a look at it. Red means you need to call someone in the middle of the night to help fix your application.
So when you go into an organization, you help them with their performance improvement. What else do you help them do?
You have to build performance into every phase of your application, especially for a large enterprise. Before you even start development, you have to understand how to make that application perform well to the end user. Incorporating performance into the testing lifecycle is very important.
So people who would attend the summit, which again is on October 29th, where is it going to be?
So it's at the Holiday Inn and Suites, Cincinnati Eastgate. The keynote presenters this year are Stuart Aitken, President and CEO of dunnhumby USA. He'll be talking about loyalty programs. And Michael Schruck, who's the Vice President and Global Analytics Leader from IBM. He'll be speaking about business analytics and optimization.
If someone listening today would like to attend, it's an all-day event, again, October 29th at the Holiday Inn over at Eastgate. How can people register for that or find more information?
So you can find more information at ohbiztechsummit.com or by calling 576-5006.
Stephen, thank you for being our guest, and thank you for listening to BusinessWise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. We're delighted today to have as our guest Jeffrey Mearns. Jeff is the president of Northern Kentucky University, and NKU has done some pretty interesting things, I think, in terms of how their K-12 catering to their students to make education so much more meaningful. One of those things is the offering of so many online courses and the way you integrate that with real live courses.
Right.
Maybe you can share that.
Yeah, so we've grown substantially over the last 5 to 10 years in terms of our online offerings. In fact, last year, more than 15% of our student credit hours were earned by students who are taking an online course. And that growth has been probably the fastest growth of any institution, four-year institution in Kentucky. But we see the use of technology going far beyond just simply online courses. It's how we use technology in the classroom. It's how we use technology to facilitate students getting content when they're not in class, so it frees up class time for more applied problem-solving exercises in class. So it's the broad spectrum of how we use technology to make learning more effective, not just more efficient.
Is the idea that the live courses will be more interactive as opposed to lecture-based, and the online would sort of replace some of the what used to be lecture-based courses?
That's right. And, you know, here at NKU, we pride ourselves on small class sizes. We pride ourselves on the personal relationships that our faculty have with the students, the fact that they know their names and they care very personally about the success of their students. So we see technology not as disrupting that relationship, but as you just said, it's a way to enhance that relationship by delivering content through technology outside of the classroom in order to facilitate the teacher-student relationship in class. But, and what I like to say, it makes it more effective and more efficient.
And then how do you use real-life experiences? I know also that you've got a lot of businesses in the region who help your students get some practical application of what they've just learned online and in the classroom.
That's right. And what we want to do, frankly, as part of our strategic plan is to expand those real world, those practical hands-on experiences, and provide more of them to our students. So that would include partnering with businesses and companies and civic organizations to provide more internships, more co-ops. Also, we're providing that kind of experience in our Center for Applied Informatics. So we're taking some of the really advanced knowledge that our students are getting in that program, but they're getting hands-on experience working on real technology problems for real clients in our Center for Applied Informatics.
Certainly parents of students who are sending a child to college, that's what they're looking for, right? It's important to understand the educational components, but then how do you apply that to the real world?
And that's what we want to do is also as part of our Student Success Center, we are integrating academic advising with career planning so that from the outset when a student arrives, they can see a pathway from their freshman year to a career.
NKU recently, actually a year or so ago, correct, became
yes.
part of the Division I level?
That's correct. This is our second year at Division I.
So how's that working, and how do you think it's, do you like it?
We had an outstanding year in our first year. We had great success on the playing fields. One of the things that I'm also proud about is that academically, our student-athletes had the highest cumulative GPA in the history of the university, so we're competing well on the court as well as in the classroom, which is very important to us. We're excited about the second year in Division I. Our men's basketball schedule is particularly intriguing. We play at Purdue, we play in Rupp Arena on November 10th against the University of Kentucky, and we play live on ESPN on Friday, December 27th against UNC, another basketball powerhouse. So it's very exciting for us.
Well, President Mearns, thank you so much for being our guest and for everything you're doing for the university and for the entire community.
Thank you.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Lori Wellinghoff. Lori is the president of Diggs Real Estate Design and Construction. She's also affiliated with Comey & Shepherd. And Lori, real estate seems to be on the upswing. I'm seeing lots of sold signs all over the place. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing sold before sent, which is industry lingo for houses selling before they ever hit the market. What we're seeing sort of inside the Beltway and even outside the Beltway to a large measure is that we are under inventoried. The buyer demand exceeds the supply. It's a good thing if you're a seller, and it's not a bad thing if you're a buyer either. Typically, under-inventoried would lead you to believe that the buyer is held hostage by the lack of choice. And while a buyer does need to be ready to buy, they should not be daunted by the fact that the sellers now hold all of the cards. They do not. The economy did adjust, as we all recall all too well, and while prices have not resume to the pre-recession highs. They have gone up significantly, in some neighborhoods upwards of 30%, but that is still off of a pretty low low. So buyers are still in the catbird seat in terms of it being adjusted pricing, and interest rates are still phenomenal. And I will date myself by letting you know that my first house was purchased with a 14% mortgage. And now 4% is still the norm for a qualified buyer. So prices are right, interest rates are right, but inventories are scarce.
If you are a buyer right now or want to be a buyer, what should you do to prepare so that if you find the house you're looking for, you can make a quick offer?
Well, first of all, one of the things that I find frustrating is that the internet has made a lot of people think that they don't need professionals anymore, and that they're smart as whips and they see everything we see. I am happy for my profession to inform those people that they are incorrect. And that in fact, if you want the best property for you, you need a couple of things. One, you need to be ready because there isn't a lot to choose from. Two, ready means have your pre-qualification letter or proof of funds, be prepared to write an offer, be prepared to be well guided by a real estate agent on what will get you the house but will not leave money on the table. But most importantly, align yourself with a real estate agent. If you know what part of town or what parts of town you want to live in, it's fairly easy using the internet or using your eyes relative to real estate signs to find the preeminent purveyors of real estate agents in those markets. So when you work with a professional, you can lay these things out in terms that are very attractive to the seller, which to your point is that it's not always about the price. You need somebody who can dig deep and find out what are the important points to the seller. For example, a seller may want to live in the house longer. That may be a really important issue that's more important than money. Back to the whole buyers thinking they know everything from the World Wide Web, I always say, you know, if you've got a pain in your side, are you going to go on the internet and figure it out, or are you going to go see a doctor? What I also think is important is real estate agents often know houses that are available for sale, but that are not on the market yet. That's that whole sold before sent vernacular, which means in the areas where I specialize, and all productive agents, we know what's coming. We talk to our fellow agents. We are constantly scanning and in touch with and networking the market. And oftentimes I can point you to the best house at the best price before the rest of the world knows it.
So if people listening today would like more information, would like to talk to you, get in touch with you, Lori, what is your contact information?
By email at Lori, L-O-R-I, at digs-home.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Lori Wellinghoff. Lori is the president of Diggs Real Estate Design and Construction, and also a real estate agent with Comey & Shepherd. And you seem to have positioned yourself somewhat uniquely in this marketplace because you're not only a real estate agent and you represent buyers and sellers of homes, but through Diggs, you actually help people, you know, refurbish, renovate, redesign their homes. What led you into this sort of unique business model?
It was sort of birthed from a pain point of mine personally, which was when you take the real estate process, the construction process, architecture, design, decorating, you become the hub in that wheel. And there's often finger pointing amongst those big silos where, you know, the architect says, hey, not my problem, it was the contractor. And decorator says, not my problem, it was the architect. And real estate agent says, well, I know I told you a new kitchen would be $10,000 when you bought this house. I'm sorry, it was $100,000. I just didn't know. And so what we saw was people were becoming increasingly time starved. We have over-programmed lives. We travel. We have soccer games until, you know, we can cheer no more. And I wanted to create a place where people could come for everything in one place or anything in one place. So people use us a la carte or in any combination. But a perfect example is when someone with little skill, little time, and little interest wants to start looking for a home. They have a finite budget. Let's just say it's $500,000. And they say, that's the maximum I want to spend. And we go through a list of must-haves and nice-to-haves, trying to get as far into the nice-to-haves as possible. Often, we'll look at a home that might be listed for $300,000, but it needs a new kitchen, a new bathroom. It needs some things that are on that must-have list. What's nice about shopping with our firm is that we can help you design and price on the fly everything you need to make that house a home. And so you can consider it in the set of all the homes you've seen, some of which are at your budget, some of which may be far below, but better suited to you.
I think what you said right out the gate about the fact that the way you came up with your business model is because it was a point of pain to you personally.
Right. Well, my biggest pain point was a footer for a foundation at my house poured about 20 feet in the wrong direction. But I was out of town traveling for business. So putting that aside, it was birthed from pain, but it was inspired by trends. So big boxes of services and of goods exist everywhere. You go to Time Warner Cable for your telephone, your internet, your television.
Sure.
You go to Target for everything from a potato to, you know, your prom
shoes.
Dress.
Exactly.
Right. And so the thought that people could throw out their Rolodex, for those of you who still know what a Rolodex is, and have a single source for everything having to do with happy homemaking, it seemed like over a time continuum, we would be a go-to resource in all things.
When you mentioned trends, and one of the trends that your organization's recently developed is this whole idea of multilingual. You've brought on a specialist. Maybe you can talk about that a bit.
Well, we're following the trends that are being set by the Chamber of Commerce here in Cincinnati, which is telling us that by 2020, they wish to have 200,000 new employees in Cincinnati beyond our current base. And that, in fact, they also are angling to ensure that our population becomes more diverse because we're in a global economy and we can't all speak the same language and think the same thoughts.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Janet Hara. Janet is the Senior Director for the Center for Economic Analysis and Development at Northern Kentucky University. Janet, thanks for being with us today. You know, the economy is such a big topic, and it certainly affects everyone. How do you think, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed that you've got some good news, how do you think that the economy is doing here in the region?
Well, you've heard of the two-handed economist. On the one hand, if you look at a lot of the indicators, most of them are up. The trends is up. They're certainly better than they were 2 years ago. On the other hand, if you want to take the other view, if you look at most of the indicators, they have not recovered to our pre-recession levels.
Why is there a disconnect? Because housing seems to be getting better, but we still have pretty high unemployment.
Well, the unemployment numbers are the same. It's, again, you know, the two-handed economist or the tale of two cities, how you want to look at it. We've had 31 straight months where employment is higher this month than it was a year ago at this time. And so we right now, we have almost 38,000 more jobs than we did this time in 2010. But if you go back and compare to where we were prior to the recession, we're still 37,000 jobs shy of our pre-recession peak. And it's the same tale when you look at the unemployment numbers. You know, the unemployment rate's down to less than 7%. We're down at about 6.9%. At the height of the recession, it was a little over 10%. But if you go back to the heydays of the late 1990s, the unemployment was running 3.5%. So I think that's part of it is who's writing the story.
Well, is it because companies have just learned to do more with less people?
There's basically three reasons. One is there's a lack of demand. I mean, you don't hire people if you can meet your demand with the staff you have. Second is it is the productivity. You can build, you can produce a lot more services with fewer people. And I think the third one is the kind of the uncertainty, and that's around Obamacare. But that cuts both ways. On the one hand, you have employers just saying, we don't want to hire because we don't know what the costs are going to be to implement Obamacare. On the other hand, you have other sectors, particularly retail and restaurants, that are reducing hours to get people under that 20 hours and then are hiring additional workers to make up for those cuts in hours. So that kind of works, that kind of cuts both ways.
But at the same time, the stock market, until just real recently, is done very well.
I think that's the other thing is we have to recognize that the stock market can be doing very well even if the labor market is not chugging along very well. And again, it goes back to how do companies make money? Well, they can make money with their current staff and be doing very well in the stock market without hiring anyone.
You know, Janet, my just anecdotal evidence that I see just with companies that I talk to and clients I have is that the skilled positions are still very much in demand. People complain that they can't find enough engineers or skilled factory workers even, but it's the unskilled or less skilled positions that seem, those are the people who seem to be lacking jobs.
What you have right now is more of a mismatch than we normally have between the skills of the workers that want to work and the jobs that are available. That's much more of a problem right now than it has been, say, 10 years ago.
Do you think that a lot of the jobs that were lost during the recession, those that were cut, Do you think they're ever coming back? Do you think that we will really see in the next several years the people that had lost the jobs that I call long-term unemployed, are they ever going to really fully get back into the workforce as they were?
There's certainly the opportunities for the long-term unemployed to get back in the workforce. Will they get back in the same jobs they had before? Probably not. Many of those jobs have gone away and will never come back. We have industry sectors that never lost jobs throughout the recession. The healthcare industry never saw a downturn in total employment throughout the entire recession, both locally and nationally. So there are sectors that are doing well, but they're not the ones that lost significant numbers of jobs during the recession.
People can look at your blogs, look at some of your articles. What's your website?
CEAD, which is CED, at nku.edu.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Janet Hara. Janet is the Senior Director of the Center for Economic Analysis and Development at Northern Kentucky University. And one of the things that I've observed recently is all the new construction that seems to be going on, particularly in terms of apartments, you know, large so-called upscale apartment projects. Is that a sign that the economy is doing better, or is that just a sign that it's easier to get financing?
Well, it's a little bit of both, because we've seen all kinds of new construction. You can drive around and see all kinds of new commercial just developments
look,
as well.
Well, look at the banks. I mean, the banks, those apartments, are, I think, are pretty much full.
But a large part of what we're seeing with the development of apartments and condos downtown is for 4 or 5 years during the recession, you couldn't get loans to build. So a lot of that is pent-up demand for that type of housing that we just simply couldn't build during the recession. The other part of that is the changing demographics. As we have more and more households that are single adults or empty nesters who do not have children, they want the lifestyle that you get by living downtown.
Do you think that trend's going to continue? Are we just in a bubble there? I mean, where do you see that going?
Well, I do think we have a little bit of built-up demand. We got that from the 5 years where we really didn't have any new construction in that type of housing. But I also think that it is a long-term demographic change. We probably will see more growth in the inner core of the cities than we have seen in the last 20 years because our family's unit is changing. Even those families that have children at home are becoming smaller. We're having fewer and fewer children. We don't need the great big yard, the great big house.
So do you think that housing just overall, just traditional homes, the values might go down?
I think that homes will still be a good investment for most families in so far that they will maintain their value. But I think the days of going back where you're going to see that's going to become my retirement nest egg is the equity in my home, those days are probably gone.
Where do you see retailers? How do you see the upcoming shopping season occurring? How do you think that will play out?
It's kind of a mixed bag. I do think it'll be a decent year. I don't think anyone's expecting fantastic growth. Probably, 3-4% increase over last year. You adjust that for inflation, it's not that much growth. But I think there'll be a real competition among retailers for every consumer dollar because consumers are still being very careful about how they spend their money.
What about the market? Where are we currently in bear, bull? Where do you see the next year or so going?
The stock market?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, I'm not a stock market analyst, but I would say one of the big keys there will be, at least in the short next 3 to 6 months, will be what happens with the Middle East.
Any last parting words of advice for folks, Janet?
I tend to be an optimist, and I want to look at the glass as half full. And for all that we still have some economic issues, most of our trends are improving, and I think we'll have another good year in 2014.
Well, thanks for ending on that high note. We appreciate it. If folks would like to get more information, I know you write a blog, you're a regular contributor for the Inquirer. What is your contact information?
Well, at the Inquirer, it's called Economic Matters is the name of my blog. We also have a website. It's called CEAD at nku.edu.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.